From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the show. They call me Ben. My compatriots Matt and Noel are on adventures, but will be returning very soon. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. We're diving into a strange one today, fellow conspiracy realist. It's a story that you may be familiar with if you are a huge fan of sports. It's a story that you may have heard a headline about, but you've never seen it fully explored. We're diving into a world of gambling. We're diving into the depths of corruption, into the heights of financial shenanigans and ethics violations. It's a mystery that is being unraveled that occurred here in the U.S. Not too long ago. What are we talking about? Well, to answer that question, we're going to defer to an expert. As we always try to do, you know that we want to bring you primary sources, people with experience and expertise in a field. And that's why today I am over the moon to welcome to the show our guest, the sports journalist, writer, and creator of the Whistleblower podcast, Tim Livingston. Tim, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So you and I have talked a bit off air about this story, which as the podcast is still coming out, Whistleblower is a term that I think a lot of people understand nowadays in the West, but Whistleblower the podcast is diving into a very specific mystery. Could you tell us just briefly, I want to be careful not to spoil too much, just briefly what Whistleblower is about, how this story begins?
The story begins with a former whistleblower, and not the one that we know about now. He has nothing to do with Russia or China or anywhere else. He's a former NBA referee named Tim Donaghy. And Tim Donaghy, for sports fans know Tim Donaghy as the most disgraced official in American sports history. I think he has that title, and whoever's in second place, it's a pretty distant second. Tim Donaghy is looked upon as a pariah, and rightfully so. However, when he got into trouble, he blew the whistle on, that's where we're going with this, Ben. He blew the whistle, the proverbial whistle, on a much bigger systemic issue within the NBA. And that issue was a culture of refereeing in which players, coaches, and team personnel were fraternizing with referees, creating relationships with referees, where just referees as the police of this game were not being policed at all. And it led to, in my opinion, corruption on an unbelievable scale, both with Donaghy himself and with other referees at the time. And so that's what we dive into. It's, okay, the narrative has always been Donaghy was a rogue criminal. It was just this guy. He's the only one. And for me, I just never believed it. I've watched so many NBA games that something just didn't feel right. And so that's where we dive in from is, what happened? What happened with Donaghy himself? And then part two is, what happened with his former employer? What happened with the NBA? What actually happened behind the scenes? What now can we look at 13 years ago and peel back layer by layer and understand on a much deeper level? And that's where this story gets really crazy, because 13 years later, more people are willing to talk. More information has come to light that might have trickled into the news at some point, but that even the most ardent sports fans don't really know. And so that's where we're going with this, and that's the crux of the podcast.
So one thing that's fascinating to me about this is your inspiration, because it sounds like you, being a fan, very familiar with the bones of the story, or at least the headlines we saw reported back in, back in 2007, I believe it started really, the rubber really started hitting the road. But it sounds like you had a tingle of your spider sense almost, right? A discrepancy. Something was rotten in Denmark. There was a glitch in the matrix. One thing that fascinates me about this is there's a line in the very beginning of the first episode where you talk about how referees are supposed to be kind of shadows, right? Almost non-entities on the court. Referees don't get noticed until they make a call that you don't like, right? Isn't that how it usually works out?
Exactly. And what a weird profession, right? You get booed out by thousands upon thousands of people every single night. You only get noticed when you mess up. You get no accolades when you're the best at what you do. And being the best at what you do means that you're invisible. It means that people have no idea who you are. It means that the game they just watched they watched it without any inkling that there were officials, right? It was just the players playing the game, and that means that you did the best job you could have done. The game was being played in its purest form. However, for basketball fans, we know that every single game that we've ever watched, there's been at least three or four times you're going to scream at the TV that call was bullshit, right? That's, we all do it as sports fans. We can't help it. We're all couch coaches or whatever you want to call us. And in the NBA, That's what exists on every single night. And for me as a fan growing up, I love basketball. I played basketball my entire life. And so I've been cognizant of the effect that a referee can have on a game since I was 5 years old. And when I was a kid, I used to have a really bad temper. And I used to scream at referees. I used to get so mad at referees when they didn't make the call that I thought was right. In rec league, right? These guys are getting paid $10 an hour back in the early 90s, and they don't want to be there. And the last thing they want is some little asshole screaming at them. I was that kid. And then as I got older, I realized that these are human beings, that you can manipulate them, right? That if you're nice to them, if you chat with them before the game, if you make them feel special, they are going to give you the benefit of more calls. So I've been fascinated by that, by the ability to influence a referee for my entire life. And for this story, though, I, having played basketball my whole life and having been in love with the sport forever, watching some of these games that took place in the early 2000s and mid-2000s, before this scandal came out, before it was exposed, before Donaghy exposed the idea, I can't say that he exposed everything, right? He just gave us an inkling of the culture and of how things operate behind the scenes. When that all came out, it made sense to me. And because I watched some of these games, some of those games were not right. They weren't officials having a bad day, in my opinion. There was no way. There was motive. There was something behind it. And that's what we're exploring in this podcast, Ben, that you mentioned. I'm pretty transparent about, like, that's where I'm coming from. I'm a journalist, but also I have eyes and I've watched these games. And so I'm not shy about the fact that I'm entering this investigation with bias, because you can't tell me the 2002 Western Conference Finals were three officials just having a bad game. I won't believe you. It didn't happen. It wasn't just one or two bad calls. It was an incredible amount, an entire game, and especially an entire fourth quarter's worth of egregious missed calls. And for me, that's where I approached this investigation, where something was amiss. What was it? How did it work? And that's what we really explore in the podcast.
You've raised a fascinating point here. It's something that I immediately thought of when you and I were first talking off air a few weeks ago about whistleblower, and you were telling us some of the nuts and bolts of the situation, which are frankly disturbing. I started thinking about the tremendous paradox that's inherent in being a referee. One of the most powerful people on the court is one of the least compensated. They're making peanuts. You know, you get, what is it? I think it's an average of $150,000 on the low end per year to a little over $500,000 or so. And that's like, depending on how you break down the math, that's what some of the players are making. You know, that's like a fraction of what they're making in a game. And so I could see very easily the opportunity for someone who is unethical to, whether through carrot or stick, incentivize the referee to make a little bit more scratch. And we know, you know, this reminded me a little bit of the conspiracy theories regarding Michael Jordan and gambling, right? Which is something we've explored in a past episode. I'm TED talking a little bit here, but I wanted to outline that because I think a lot of people, myself included, to be transparent, didn't really consider the discrepancy there. The fact that, like, you know, I'm making $250,000 for the whole year. That's what I'm going to make unless I moonlight, right, somewhere else. And these folks that I'm calling, that I'm making calls on, no matter what happens to them, win or lose, they're multimillionaires. So it doesn't seem like it would take much for the push. But okay, so the idea of rigged sports, it's tremendously controversial because any fan of sports, any fan of any sport wants the rules to be followed, right? Ostensibly, we want the game to be competitive. We want the athletes at the top of their abilities, and we want the rules followed so that a win is a real win and not invalidated, and not turning into some like mafia-esque con job. Could you tell us a little bit about what Donaghy was going through that pushed him to this? Like before, like, okay, so he clearly was a crooked ref, right? There's no question about that. Is that correct?
No question. And to your point, think about it, right? If going back to the Michael Jordan Bulls, think about how much power a referee has. Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen step on the court. A referee could give both of them two technical fouls for no reason, right when they walk on the court, eject them both from the game, and the Bulls have to play the rest of the game without Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen. No referee's ever done that. And probably ever will. That's a little bit too obvious. But think about how much power a referee has, right? Because he can also call two ticky-tack fouls on Scottie Pippen and two ticky-tack fouls on Michael Jordan and force them to watch the rest of the first quarter from the bench. And if you're betting against the spread, that's hugely advantageous if you're a referee and you have money on the game, right? So, or against the Bulls in that game. So a referee has an incredible amount of power. And for sports fans who don't want to believe that there's any possible corruption in sports, just using basketball as an example, the referees, to your point, make 1/10, 1/20, sometimes 1/50 as much as the guys who are yelling at them, screaming in their face night after night after night. How can they not, over time or immediately, how can there not be bias, right? These guys aren't robots, they're humans. And with guys that have ego, like Tim Donaghy, that, and again, I don't think Donaghy's the only referee that was fixing games over the course of the history of basketball. I think that would be incredibly naive to believe that. The question for me is, how many were there and how high up did it go? So in episode 2, we interview Michael Franzis, who you might have seen in Netflix's Fear City, one of the most brilliant members of the mafia of all time, a guy who was running schemes that were making millions upon millions of dollars a day. And just a very... he was a criminal, but he was a damn good one. And he talks about how he had two NBA referees on his payroll in the 90s that weren't Tim Donaghy, right? So this is one mobster with two NBA refs on his payroll that were not the guy that we're focusing on. And that gives you an idea of, A, and this is what Francis says, it was easy to fix a game. It's not hard when it's against the spread. It's hard if you need one team to win, right? So some of the games that I'm referencing from the playoffs and finals where there was the foul discrepancies, you know, there's one team is shooting 60 free throws, the other team is shooting 30. That's where it gets egregious. And as fans, you know, those are the games that we still talk about to this day, because a lot of us don't feel that those were on the up and up. But when it comes just to the spread, that's easy. If the Bulls are supposed to win by 10 and you got a bet on the other team to cover that spread for, you know, if the Bulls need to win by 9 or less for you to win your bet, yeah, call 2 quick fouls on Michael Jordan, put him on the bench, and you're probably in really good shape for the rest. That right there probably affects the point spread by 3 or 4 points immediately. And if the Bulls are up by 11 and in the fourth quarter, start calling more fouls than the Bulls. And you as a referee can really dictate whether the Bulls win by 8 points or 12 points. So that's exactly. And that's where it gets interesting. That's where we as fans have to look at the system and look at how easy it is for these guys to manipulate a game and put in. The NBA has put in checks and balances since Donaghy. They've done an okay job of improving the system. There are a lot more referees who are anonymous, who are invisible, who do a great job. However, there are still referees that have been refereeing for 25 plus years who, one of them, Scott Foster, was Donaghy's best friend. And him and Tim Donaghy talked 134 times on the phone at the height of the scheme from October 2006 to March 2007 on the phone that Donaghy used as what the FBI said. Donaghy used this phone for gambling, primarily for gambling related purposes. And Scott Foster's the top official in the NBA, right? So there's all this circumstantial evidence that points to Scott Foster and Donaghy having a relationship that minimally needs to be explored further. And this guy's being, when we watch the NBA finals this year, Scott Foster's going to ref 2 of those games. And that's the guy that I'm supposed to trust has integrity and that I'm supposed to trust, you know, is going to create an even playing field for both these teams and not let his ego or bias or anything else infiltrate. Yeah. Okay. I don't, we got a long way to go. But yeah, when it comes to the scandal this time in 2007, I think it went, and this is what we explore in the podcast, I believe that it went really, really deep, and it's really fascinating what Donaghy was doing. And then it's also, for me, on the conspiracy side, way more interesting what the league, what the NBA was doing to make this problem go away.
So, yeah, let's explore a couple of those points. So first off, to me, it's still, you probably hear me laughing in the background, folks, it's still hilarious to me when you, Tim, were first telling us in our earlier conversations about a gambling phone. Like, I've heard of a burner phone, but I've never known someone who gambles so frequently that at some point they're like, I need a different phone for this. I need a family plan.
Yeah, several burner phones, and this one was like primarily the gambling phone. But Donaghy himself, there were so many tentacles. He was betting with at least 2 people that we know about that were part of the scandal that were the FBI found. At least 2. We speculate that he was probably betting with 3, 4, or 5 other people, right? Hey, Ben, can you place, you know, this is the pick tonight. Put $500 on the Bulls for me and kick me back, you know, $300. Just bring the cash next time I see you. That's where it gets crazy. And you got to wonder if you look at Donaghy's phone records, think about how easy it is for that money to move without a trace. If it's just cash, if it's at levels that aren't in the millions, which are what was being bet on Donaghy's games in the professional betting markets. When Tim Donaghy reffed a game, there were millions of dollars being moved by the mafia, by the Gambino crime family, and by various professional betting syndicates on each game that he refereed. Tim Donaghy refereed 260 games over the course of the scheme. So you do the math. Were there hundreds of millions wagered and won on Tim Donaghy's games by organized crime and other shady outlets? At least, right? We know it's hundreds of millions. Were there billions? Maybe. And that's crazy. That's one referee's games. So now expand that there's 53 referees in the NBA. And let's look at college. College is even easier. Hofstra is playing Northeastern. Anybody watching that game? Anybody going to notice if a couple grands placed here and there and all over the country and Northeastern shoots 62 free throws and Hofstra only shoots 25? Probably not. So that's where, again, as basketball fans, I think the big thing I would love to see from our podcast is just a demand for better checks and balances, a demand for greater transparency, and just a demand that our game, the game that we love, is improved from an officiating standpoint, because we're still not there yet.
and we'll pause here for a word from our sponsor before we return to examine this strange tale of conspiracy, corruption, and sports with Tim Livingston. And we're back. This is, to me, one of the roots of the dilemma. First, though, I have to ask, and I know there's a question a lot of our fellow listeners are wondering now. The process you describe is so subtle, right? And it's so easy to make, to make $10 million through a series of relatively innocuous seeming bets instead of one big $10 million pot. This stuff being so easy to miss, it makes me wonder how someone got wind of this. How did this guy go from being, you know, one of the top, most established referees in the business to this pariah, to this person who was, I believe one of the descriptions you use is scapegoated, right? Like NBA wanted a bad guy.
So to answer your question, Donahue was betting on his own games. So we can assume if he's betting on his own games, I think we proved pretty definitively in the first couple episodes that Donahue was fixing any game that he bet on and was refereeing, obviously, right? I mean, the FBI made him admit that he at least subconsciously might have manipulated games that he was refereeing and had money on. But I think we prove, again, without a reason, I don't think there's any doubt after the first couple episodes of our podcast that Donahue knew what he was doing and that he was fixing those games. So Donahue is fixing games for 4 years. And what I think is interesting, in 2007, when he got caught, if it wasn't for the scheme getting too big, if it wasn't for this guy, Jimmy Baba Batista, Donahue's not really friend from high school, but a guy that he had grew up with and known his entire life and became a professional gambler. If it wasn't for Jimmy Batista getting involved, Jimmy Batista was at the time addicted to pills, cocaine, and everything else under the sun that you could smoke, swallow, or inhale in any way. I'm trying to think of, I haven't done drugs in a while, so this is, I hope my wife is listening for that reason, for the fact that I stuttered over how to do drugs. But Batista was an admitted addict. I mean, he went to rehab towards the end of the scheme. And if it wasn't for Batista being in that state, and he went into debt, he was winning 80, 90% of his picks, which is a professional gambler. That's how you go buy an island, right? You're printing money. It's like, hey, in 1990, hey, invest in Apple. There's going to be a company, Google, that's going to IPO in like 2003. Yeah, invest in that. You know, it's not fair. You're not playing on an even playing field. But Batista, because of his addiction and because of his hubris, went into debt and started talking. And he mentioned it to too many people. The scheme got too big. There was too much money moving. And ultimately, it just came down to him talking to a informant. It was an informant for the Gambino crime family. And they caught it on a wiretap, and boom, FBI is like, wait, what? You have a referee in your pocket? And they started listening, and they started, they did their due diligence, and they're the FBI. They figured it out in a week or two, and Donahue was the guy, and they knew. What's interesting, Ben, to your point, is if Donahue kept it relatively small, if it was what he was doing the first couple of years with a couple of friends, and the circle was small, circle was tight, would he still be refereeing in the NBA today? And I believe the answer is yes, unequivocally. I think if a referee was doing this today, we'd have no real way of knowing. It's completely undetectable. And that's a problem. that's a big problem. And so Donahue, and if you listen to Tommy Martino, who was the middleman between Donahue and Batista, Tommy Martino says they're having the time of their lives. They're making gobs of money, and they were criminals, but they never thought they'd get caught. And when criminals don't think they're going to get caught and think that they're just going to make this kind of money and live this kind of lifestyle forever, they have fun. And so Donahue eventually realized, the FBI started knocking, and he quickly went and confessed everything, became a cooperator, because that's how he only got 15 months in prison from all this. But that's what's interesting. Could this have gone on in perpetuity? And again, I think the answer is yes.
And does it go on today, which it seems like there's, I don't know. No, for everybody listening, of course, the entirety of Whistleblowers is not out yet. The story is ongoing and you should check it out today. But having listened to the show, what I can say is I live in the world of conspiracies, man. And there are a ton of conspiracy theories that are just easily debunked or disproven or don't add up. But I would say this is not a conspiracy theory. This is an actual conspiracy. Donnie conspired to do these things. And as I was listening, you know, one thing that struck me is, Tim, I massively appreciate you saying at the very top, look, I'm a journalist. I came in with it. I'm convinced something is up here. Something's amiss. Because as I was listening, I ended up completely agreeing. So there might not be like the FBI's equivalent. There might not be something that meets the FBI's equivalent of a smoking gun or a fire with Foster and with some other close relationships. But there's a lot of smoke. You show a lot of smoke in this show, and it makes me think that the money and the opportunity is probably too good for some people to walk away from for a number of reasons, like human ego, like you said, but also just the financial aspect. I wanted to ask, you know, as an outsider, I, like many people, many of our fellow listeners, am not a professional referee. How well did these guys all know each other? That's one of the big questions I think a lot of people have. Is it like a clock in, clock out job? Are you like, once you get in the rarefied air of being a professional NBA referee, don't you kind of know of all the other people in that sphere?
Absolutely. These guys have all been working together for forever. They exist in a very strange bubble. And right now, for those that are actually in Orlando, that's a funny term to use, considering that the NBA right now is in a literal bubble. But referees, there's only about 55 NBA referees reffing per season. Most of them, for the most part, I mean, it's some of them only last 2 or 3 years and get canned. The ones who make it, though, they referee forever. They're in the league for 15, 20, 25, sometimes 25 plus years. And they become synonymous with the show. And that's what's interesting, right? And that's what we're exploring is how much of this is entertainment and how much of basketball, professional basketball, is legitimate competition. And where do those lines blur? But the referees all know each other very well for the most part. Some of them hate each other. Some of them think that, you know, referee X might think referee Y is the worst referee ever. And, you know, he's a show off and he makes the game all about himself. And, you know, some of those things came to light actually after the Donaghy scandal. The NBA commissioned its own report. You know, like we're gonna really nail down and look at our system and look at our culture and fix what's wrong, right? And we're gonna pay a lawyer to do it. So this lawyer's gonna be he's independent. He's gonna be completely independent. This investigation is not going to try and you know, cast doubt on some of the more salacious things that have been alleged during the scandal. This is an investigation we can all trust. And so the Pedowitz report, which is the NBA report that I'm referring to after the Donaghy scandal, it still says it looks at NBA referee relationships and it talks about some of this stuff, right? How some of these guys look at Dick Pivetta, who's the most senior official during this time, and think that he was far too, intertwined in the game. That he made the game about himself, right? Which, according to my definition of what makes a good referee, is the exact opposite thing that you should do. Dick Pivetta, according to Donaghy, had an American Airlines pilot that he would call after every game to, and this again, according to Donaghy, I can't prove this. I never talked with the stewardess, American Airlines stewardess, but he used to call a stewardess friend of his after every game and to get a report on how much airtime he got during that game. So if that's true, that's really bad, right? That's really, really bad. But another interesting thing, Ben, to your point, 15 or so referees, again, tight fraternity, not that many, 15 hail from Delaware County, Pennsylvania, hail from the greater Philadelphia area, which over the course of of refereeing in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, and now into 2020, a lot of referees hail from this one area of Philadelphia, and which, as we find out in the podcast, is a gambling hotbed. And that's where Donahue's from, and Steve Jaffe and Joey Crawford. And if you know NBA referees, I could go on and on, but they all hail from this one area in and around Philadelphia. So it's certainly suspicious. It's not really a meritocracy. It's incredibly, Donahue's a product of nepotism. His uncle was an NBA referee. His father was a college referee. So yeah, all these guys, it's gotten better. I think referees now, it's definitely more of a meritocracy as far as I can tell. But really at the time it was who you knew and who your dad was or who your uncle was.
I mean, that's insane because we know that nepotism often wins the day over meritocracy in any number of fields or pursuits, but the appeal of sports in general is the idea that through one's own hard work, focused practice, and natural talent, you can leave everything else that's outside of the court, off the court when you play the game. And for that not to be the case, it's got to be just a profound punch in the gut, you know, especially for a lot of kids who, like you, were growing up living, breathing, loving basketball, you know, and now to find that this may very well be rigged. I mean, it's understandable that people would say, well, this is a bad apple situation, right? This is a bad actor. It's a one-off. In the NBA, you know, as you've explored, the NBA goes into crisis mode, kind of, in their PR and their damage control. But one of the big twists that comes about, there are two big twists, I think, that are going to be startling, is first, the NBA's damage control, their PR, their report, it didn't do the best job persuading people that this was a one-off. And I think Donaghy himself didn't agree with their findings. And I know this because of another big twist in our story, which is that, Tim, you talked to him. Everybody should look. If you're not familiar with this character, we want to establish this. Tim Donaghy is alive today. And you, Tim, have had like multiple conversations with him.
Multiple. And this is, we start off, and what I'll say now that we're a little farther, because people have asked me since we started, when we started this podcast, the reason I had access to Donahue is because Donahue and I were very friendly. I'm the only, when I was writing for the Post Game, which was a Yahoo site back in 2012, I'm the first one, I think the only person, at least, you know, according to Google search results, which I've done, you know, I've Google searched this ardently over the past 8 years. Right. I think I'm the only one who said that publicly, right? That I believe what Tim Donaghy is saying about the culture of the NBA. I said in so many words, Donaghy, we know what Donaghy is. He's not the best guy, but he's also, I think he's a scapegoat for a bigger systemic issue. And I think that the reason I'm the only one to have written those words or something far more eloquent in my actual article, hopefully. I think the reason I'm the one who was able to say that is because I wasn't employed by the NBA, right? If you're an NBA beat writer and you believe what Tim Donaghy's saying, you can't say that. You're not going to get access to any locker room. You're not going to get access to any player. You're going to become a pariah. You can't say that. And most crime reporters, and I'm sure a lot of the stories that you guys explore from a journalistic perspective, you know, crime and sports is not usually something we look at or that crime reporters look at. Most crime reporters don't gravitate towards sports to say, oh, what's the deal here? What's the scandal here? What's the corruption here? So I just, as a freelance sports writer without any ties to the NBA, found myself in this very odd position. And then after I wrote the article, Tim Donaghy reached out to me and said, thank you so much for writing this. And that's where we became friends. And now, look, at the same time, I'm a journalist, right? So I did my research. I've investigated this story basically from that day over the course of 8+ years. And what I found when it comes to Donaghy is that he, in fact, is lying about a lot of things, in my opinion. And because of that, we were forced to reveal those things over the course of the podcast. So Tim Donaghy, I don't think is my friend any longer, Ben, unfortunately, or not unfortunately, I don't really care. But Tim Donaghy is no longer doesn't like me anymore, and that's fine because I still like Tim. I've no issue with Tim, and all I want is to find the truth at the heart of this scandal, at the heart of this conspiracy. Because I really appreciate you saying that it's not a conspiracy theory. There's no theory. It's really just a question of how deep the conspiracy goes. And that's what our podcast is about. And that's what, unfortunately, for 13 years, people in my world, in the sports world, have been too hesitant to investigate for reasons that are completely rational. If you're an NBA writer, you want a job. You got to feed your family. I get it. At the same time, this is the darkest moment in the history of basketball. And to make the sport better, you need to understand its faults and why, you know, what needs improving. And so that's where this journey kind of kicked off from. But yeah, Tim Donaghy is a central part of our story. And I think what's interesting for myself and the audience is deciphering what's true and what's not true.
Let's pause for a brief word from our sponsor before we return with more on the still developing tale of Whistleblower with Tim Livingston. And we're back. These shows, both Whistleblower and Stuff They Want You to Know, have something in common, which is pursuing the truth, even when pursuing the truth is not a popular or even safe thing at times. One thing that stands out to me that surprises me, that I haven't thought about really until exploring Whistleblower and until speaking with you, is the idea that the NBA could wield such profound, pervasive influence over what is supposed to be objective reporting. So is it true that the NBA can just stonewall or blacklist a journalist, or can they shut down and silence a story? Or is it more that the journalists themselves are kind of proactively self-selecting and avoiding things they think will get them in trouble?
That's a great question. And again, the media side of this is super, super interesting and something that we explore in the second half of the podcast. So I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but right, I will say that in my opinion, during the David Stern era of the NBA, and David Stern, for those who don't know, was the commissioner from 1984 to 2014. David Stern is, and this is what we're, if you're listening to Whistleblower right now, you haven't heard this, or we're about to start revealing in episodes 5, 6, and 7, which are coming out over the next, you'll have heard 5 and 6 and 7 are about to come out. But the NBA was an entity you did not mess with. And that is not me saying that. That's other journalists that I've spoken with. Murray Weiss, a former New York Post reporter who broke the story in the NBA, said those words very clearly, right? You're about to hear Murray Weiss say that, right? Where people warned him, don't mess with the NBA, don't mess with David Stern. David Stern did not mess around. David Stern was a monarch. He really was. And he was brilliant. And he's a fascinating character in this that we really are going to dive into his psyche, going to dive into how he ran the league. And the way he ran the league, it wouldn't work in 2020, but it worked very well in the 90s and early 2000s. He was not a social media era guy. He said things that would just be absolutely destroyed with the way we disseminate news and at the speed with which we disseminate news today. But the NBA, in my estimation, in my opinion, which hopefully at this point your audience values at least somewhat as somebody who has spent 8 years. If you guys don't, if you think I'm an idiot, that's fine as well. But my opinion is that, yes, the NBA was somebody, was a company, right? Was a thing that you did not mess with and that people were very scared of. And it wasn't just, they would go to great lengths to make stories like this go away. And we explore with the Donaghy scandal, the great lengths that they made for this story to go away. And it's fascinating.
Now, I do have to say, I've been personally impressed by the thoroughness of the reporting, especially when, you know, in a very real way, you're telling a story that doesn't want to be told, right? Even in the modern day. And one thing we have to let you know, if you're listening to the show today, is that me and Matt and Noel and Mission Control and Doc Holliday, codenamed Doc Holliday, Tim isn't giving us a preview of the episodes. So all the stuff that you just said, Tim, with my question, it's stuff that I have to wait for the next episode to hear, which I think is fantastic. I just want to say that, you know, unlike some players of the NBA, we're not getting special treatment here. So we are listening along with you folks. Perhaps one way to close today's episode before everybody goes and checks out Whistleblowers for ourselves is to go back to something that you posed that I think is of crucial importance here. So there's this idea of checks and balances, right? And how best to institute them, but it seems so complicated. It seems like it's a very tall order. Do you have things like checks and balances that you think would mitigate this problem? I mean, is there a solution? Because I'm not an expert. I'm not like the king of referees or anything like that. And I was thinking through this and I don't know. It outsmarted me. It's just so easy to get away with it, you know?
Yeah, and I think the first step is right now the referees are employed by the NBA. So, for example, during the David Stern era, David Stern somewhat facetiously replied during a Dan Patrick interview in 2004 about his dream NBA Finals matchup. He said, "Lakers versus Lakers is the league. That's what the league wants to see." And as a Lakers, look, I grew up a Lakers fan, right? The Lakers.
You got the hat on.
I got the LA hat on. It's interesting because the Lakers were for ratings, which the NBA cared a lot about. The NBA makes a majority of its money via television. The TV contracts they've signed over the last 20 years have just gone up by the billions. It's gone from hundreds of millions to billions to multi-billions. And last year, the NBA did almost $9 billion in revenue. So if you're valuing the NBA as a company, they're give or take a $35 billion company. They're a huge corporation. They're a very, very powerful corporation. And so the first thing you need to do is make the referees, you need to create a separate employment agency. You can't have the NBA employ referees because if the Lakers are playing whichever team in the Western Conference Finals and that referee has in his head that David Stern, his boss's 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 boss, is rooting for the Lakers to reach the next game, that's a problem, right? So that's step one is, and Phil Jackson, former Lakers coach, is the one who suggested that first, or at least, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people had suggested before Phil Jackson, but I think Phil Jackson, 11-time NBA champion, he's a smart guy. He knows his teams have been privy to different officiating than a lot of other teams. And that's one anecdote that Donahue provides in our opening episodes where Phil Jackson, where he calls Michael Jordan for a travel and Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson flip out and Phil Jackson, you know, Donahue says, "You watch the same training tapes as I do." And Phil Jackson says, "Yeah, they might want that call to travel, but not on Michael Jordan." So it's the same kind of bias and talent discrimination that exists throughout the league. And a call, the right call should be the right call every single time. And it's not in the NBA. There's biases and different rules for different players, and it's not an even playing field. And to get there, the first step is to make referees part of a different organization that has no ties with the NBA. And that's step one. And that's a big step. Do I think it's going to happen? I don't know. I don't think anytime soon, because definitely during the David Stern era, I think the NBA enjoyed having that control. And I think they giving that up would be something that they would really, really have to be pushed into a hole to do. But that's the first step in the solution. And then you got to make sure that that agency, that organization is run well and run with integrity. But right now, the NBA having control essentially over the employment of its officials creates a conflict of interest. It's too wide a chasm to overcome.
Yeah, this is reminding me of all those memes where you see like a tiny hero standing up against some gigantic colossus on the horizon. That's an enormous conflict of interest. And you know what I like about this point, Tim, and what I like about I called some of my friends who are living, breathing, God bless them for their optimism, Atlanta basketball fans, and a lot of folks here are somehow familiar with the problem you're addressing just at the very offset of whistleblower, and it's this. I think, you know, if you love basketball, then of course you feel like there's been several terrible calls, as you said, Tim, 2, 3, 4 per game. So I think a lot of our listeners are already excited to see some very real proof that they weren't just being, you know, sore loser fans or something like that. And so we turn it over to you folks. Don't take my word for it. Do check out Whistleblower. It's available wherever you find your favorite podcast on any platform. As we said, we actually waited a little bit on this interview because we didn't want to have the interview here while episode one was just out, because there's so much stuff on the horizon that we can't yet talk about. And Tim, thank you for being patient with me. I know you totally caught me trying to slide in getting a little more info. I guess I'll just have to wait. I'll have to wait till next week. But
I appreciate it, Ben. No, it's great. I could talk about this stuff all day. So after episode 10 comes out, I'll come back on and we can dive even deeper. But I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun. And yeah, check out Whistleblower. I think you guys will like it.
In the meantime, Tim, for anyone who would like to learn more about your overall work, where can they find you online?
I'm on Twitter at Tim Likes Sports. It's a handle that I think I got in like 2012 or 2013 that I'm going to stick with, because I still like sports even after learning about all the terrible things that have happened in the world that I love. So yeah, Tim Likes Sports on Twitter, and that's where I'm most active on the social medias.
Again, you can also find Tim on the No Chill podcast. If you are like me, waiting for the end of Whistleblower. In the meantime, while you're on the internet, you can also find stuff they don't want you to know. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter. If you have listened to our multiple episodes about big data and you are still on Facebook, then check out our group page. Here's where it gets crazy. You can leave us a phone number if you don't sip the social meds, 1-833-STDWYTK. Let us know if you want us to use your name on air or not. We can't wait to hear your input, your feedback on Whistleblower. How deep do you think this goes? How high and wide do you think this conspiracy reaches? If you don't like phones, it's 2020, I get it, real friends text, and you don't like social media, there's one way you can always contact us. We have a good old-fashioned email address where we are, conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.